We're on Daf Kuf Yud Dalet, and we've managed to cover the Mishnah and a little bit of the Gemara, and we're up to Tanan Hasam. So if you have the wide lines, it's like smack in the middle of the wide lines. The first word in the line, I think, is Mishum. Let's just review so we know what we're about to embark upon. The question is there an assumption of Yeish? For example, let's say the case of a Gazlan. Does the Nigzal give up hope, or is he holding out that maybe he'll get it back? And the Gemara vacillates back and forth within the context of Rashi's statement. Is there a difference between a Gazlan who's an Akum, a Gazlan who's a Yisrael? The Gemara thought initially that if it's a Gazlan who's a Yisrael, then he's not going to be Mesialish. He has more of a recourse to go into a Bezdin and get his money back. The Gemara comes to the opposite conclusion, that Dafka, in the case of a Gazlan, Oved Kochavim, there he has more of a chance of successfully going to the non-Jewish courts, which are very tough, and he'll get his money back. So at this point, we have an assumption of Yeish. Now, if you take a look at the Lashon of the Mishnah says, Natlo Muchsin, and then he has Natlo Listim, and in all these cases, there's an assumption of Yeish. So the assumption of Yeish here in our Mishnah applies to two cases. One is the case of Muchsin, and the other is the case of Listin. Now it's important for us to understand that Muchsin and Listin belong to two different categories, whereas Muchsin belong to what's called a Gazlan category, Listim belongs to a Ganov category. Now the difference between a Ganov and a Gazlan, generally speaking, again we'll get into some of the more finer details, is that in the case of a Gazlan, there's a face-to-face confrontation between the Gazlan and the Nigzal. They actually see each other. You know, he comes to him and he says, your money or your life. In the case of a Ganov, he's b'machbo. He comes stealthily and he sneaks in. Let's say he borrows his way in through the basement. So in the case of a moches, clearly this moches, this tax collector, is a gazlan, meaning he's facing you and he's confiscating your property. The word listim, however, unless it's a case of a listim mezuyon, which we'll get to later on, an armed robber, that's a different kind of listim, but the word listim is used to refer to a gan, which means that there's no face-to-face. The Ganav is afraid to accost you, but rather he sneaks in. But in both cases, the Mishnah in the Reisha establishes Mipnei Shabbailam Misyashim. Now that means that we don't even have to know for sure that the Bailam are Misyashim. There's an assumption of Yeish. And how that works is going to be the subject of our sugya. So Tanan Hasam. This is Masechta Kelim, the 26th perek of Masechta Kelim. Okay. It says the following. Let's just give a little bit of an introduction. We have in the universe two categories of objects, of carbon, so to speak. We have what's called raw materials, and we have the final product. Now, in Lashon Kodesh, this is called Gmar Malachton. Gmar Malachton is when you take something that exists in nature and you perfect it until the point that now it has what's called a Shem Kli. A Kli means it has a function. Now, you and I would say, logically, that in every society, different objects can be used or not used in different ways, but it should be an objective determination. In other words, we should look at the object and determine whether it's in its raw state or it's already made into a kli. You could have something that in its natural state could be used as a kli, but be that as it may, in that society, the object has a function. It's functional. And therefore the Shem Kli should be Chal Me'elav. Me'elav means automatically. We shouldn't need a human intervention in order to generate a Shem Kli. However, since all of Masechta Kelim is based on the premise, number one, that only a kli is makabel tumah, raw material, if it's not a kli, it's not a vessel, it's not functional, it's not designated for use, it's not makabel tumah, then we need what's called gemar malachton in order for it to become a kli, so that now it's makabel tumah. How does this gemar malachton come to be? So we need two conditions. We need, number one, the bailim, which means the owner, and that's where we come to the laws of Gzela and Geneva here, because we want to know if the gazlan is considered the bailim. Does he own the object? And number two, we need what's called machshava. Now, what does machshava mean? And why is machshava effective in order to establish a shame clue? We have here the introduction of a subjective element into the picture. We're no longer interested in whether the average person on the street would be using this object as is, or would wait until there's a gemar malacha, but rather we're interested in this specific person who is called a bailam. Now, the assumption is that everything in the universe could be functional. Anything could be functional under dire situations. And if the need would come to pass, there would be a shem kli, and it would be makabel tumah. So anything in the universe really potentially could be makabel tumah. What we have to do is, we have to, in a sense, take it out of the state of a kli.
Material.
And assuming it's material, it's not going to be makabel tumah. So again, what I'm saying is that here, the premise is guilty until proven innocent. And you need some sort of positive force to undermine the shame kli. Everything could be a kli because anything could be used for anything. You can come up with, if you use your imagination, you'll come up with a use for any physical object. You know, if you have to keep the door open and you need something because the wind is blowing the door, you'll take anything. As long as it has some substance to it, it'll keep the door open. Again, it might have to have some weight and some volume and so forth. So therefore, in order to remove the shame kli, we have to come along and say that, you know what? It's not functional. Even though it could be functional, for sure, you know, if you're stuck and you're out there, you know, you're on the Titanic and it falls down, you never know when you'll need it to save yourself from the raging sea. But we're going to introduce here the subjective element. And the individual will determine whether or not it's fit for use, it's designated for use, it has a shame kli. Again, the object per se in the objective universe could be used. It has that yicholit, it has that efsharut, it has the potential to be used. But the chiddush here of tumah v'tara is that there's something called a shem kli, and that shem kli will depend upon the person. Now, you and I might think that the person has to do an action. He's got to change the physical universe in order to establish shem kli. And the chiddush is no, because since the kli itself in its natural state is a kli, meaning it has the potential for use, all I need is what I call a haskama. Haskama means I need the agreement of a person. What do you mean, the agreement of a person? I don't have to do anything actively. I don't have to change the object in order for there to be a shame kli. I just have to say, you know what? As is, it has a function for me. And that's called machshava. Normally, in the world of halacha, machshava is called... Anybody know what that's called in the world of halacha? I'll give you a hint. It starts with dvarim. Dvarim shevalev. And the principle is that dvarim shevalev, lo avi dvarim. Normally, machshava is not sufficient. Machshava doesn't change the world. We need either a maisa, we need a shinui, and the halacha is determined by that. So, for example, there's a parsha in the Torah called B'nei Gad U'B'nei Reuven, which is the parsha of Tanai. A person can have in mind all sorts of conditions. But until he does an amira, in this case the amira functions as a maisa, then he objectifies his machshava, and once that machshava is in the objective universe, the halacha can deal with it. But as long as it's begetter machshava, the halacha can't deal with it. There are various exceptions to this case. For example, there are three lavim in the Torah where you chayv b'machshava. Not only that, there's even a case of Hegdesh, which is Chal b'machshava, possibly even Afrosh is true. And all this has to be understood. And basically, the principle is always going to be the following. If the object in and of itself has the potential, I just need a haskama, I just need to accept the situation and approve of it, then machshava is enough. Any object in the world potentially could belong to Hegdesh. That's a pasuk in Tehillim. David HaMelech declares, Lashem ha'aretzim olo. Lashem means Lashem Hegdesh. And now I just have to agree that it should be Hegdesh. Therefore, Hegdesh could be Chal v'machshav. A neder, on the other hand, means to create something new in the universe. There's no potential neder inherent in this table. And therefore, I need what's called a haflas peh. The haflas peh objectifies my machshava, and then my machshava is meaningful. In Tanoim, if I want to make a tanai, and the purpose of the tanai is to undermine a maisa kinyan, then I need dibur. Machshava is not enough. That becomes dvarim shebelev, and dvarim shebelev lo amin dvarim. In the world of tumah v'tara, everything is considered potentially usable, functional, and therefore it has the same clip. But I need machshava. Now, given that introduction, we come to the laws of a mocher and a lokeach. In the case of a mocher and a lokeach, it's a very complicated situation. On the one hand, at this moment, who's the bailim? It hasn't been sold yet, the mocher. But on the other hand, who's going to determine whether it's functional? The lokeach wants to buy something that's functional. It could be the mocher has in mind a certain function, you know, as I say, b'shas hadchak, you know, if everything is lost, you know, we'll use it, it's b'dieved, but we'll have to use it. But that's not what the lokeach has in mind. The lokeach wants to buy something that's functional from his perspective. And now, since we said that tuma v'tara, the shame klifa kabbalas tuma, is determined subjectively, we can raise the question, well, which subject should determine whether we have gemara malacha, whether it's already established, we've approved of its use? Should it be the mocher or should it be the lokeach? And the chiddush here is an amazing chiddush. The mocher depends upon the lokeach. Why is the mocher depend upon the lokeach? Why is the machshava the lokeach? Why do we have to satisfy his machshava, his anticipation? Because what is the mocher using this object for? For himself? What he needs is what? He needs the box. He needs the money. So therefore the function and the machshava of Gemara Malach is now going to be determined by the anticipation of the buyer of the lokeach, because the mocher wants to satisfy the lokeach. The mocher is not using it for himself. So now we have two categories. We have the classical category of a bailim. He's going to decide what his needs are, and if he decides for machshava that he needs it as is, that creates a Gemara Malach and the Shem Kli, and it's makabel to him. Then we have the exception to that rule, where even though the lokeach is not the bailim, he's in the driver's seat to determine the machshava that will establish the gemar malacha, because the mocher, in order to sell this object, since he's not using it for his own personal use, he's going to have to satisfy the lokeach. Now, in the case of a gazlan, presumably, at this point, he's not selling it. If he decides to sell it, it becomes more complicated. So what's the classical case of an object that exists as a raw material in the universe? It could be functional, if need be, but the bailim decide that they want to postpone the raw material until it becomes a more sophisticated kli. The classical case is what's called oros, with an ayin. And that means skins, hide. So you take the hide off an animal, and if need be, you know, if you can't find the tablecloth, or you need, you know, you want to sleep out, you know, out in the woods, and you need some sort of a even a makeshift kind of blanket or sheet, so you'll sleep on oros. But the classical use of an oros, and this is where the producer, so to speak, makes his money, is to make it into shoes, to min'olim. Now the buyer is not interested in buying hot. He wants a finished product. So what he wants is the Gemar Malacha that it's ready to be used as a minhag. So having said that, we're ready for the Mishnah in the 26th Perek of Kalim. And the Mishnah says the following. That again, normally a kli requires Gemar Malachta, unless the owner of the kli decides that he wants to use it, and he designates as such in his Machshava, even though it's only a raw material, and it hasn't been Gemar Malachta. So that's going to be his decision. We anticipate that he's going to want to finish up the kli so that it's fully functional, and therefore his machshava is going to be, wait till I do the real makava patish, the final blow. Correct? However, there are situations in which the exceptional scenario is that he'll use it as is. What happens if he's selling it? So on the one hand, he's the buyer, but on the other hand, as we said, he wants to satisfy his locale, who's buying it. So the Mishnah establishes that oros shel bala bayis, you have a raw material here, in this case a hide, is machshava mitam osan. What does that mean? A bala bayis is not a mocher. He's not out there to manufacture products and vessels and sell them on the market. He has decided through his machshava that even though it's a raw material at this point, that's what he's going to use it for. He's going to take this hide and he's going to use it as a tablecloth. He's going to sit on the ground on top of the hide. That machshava itself clinches the approval that the raw material itself now is functional. Even though, again, he made no statement, he didn't do any action, he's got the hide in its natural form on the table, and he hasn't changed anything, he didn't sew it up, make it into a shoe, nothing. But machshava itself is capable of generating a shame kli as far as Kabbalah's tool is concerned. Mind you, that in other areas of halacha, we would apply the principle of Dvarim Shebelev Lo'avi, Dvar Machshava would not be sufficient. So let's say, for example, if I were to convince you, which I don't know if I could, that if you take a raw material on Shabbos and you create a kli out of it, that you chayev for one of the malachas of the 39 malachas. Anybody know which malach I have in mind? Makabit Patish, for sure. It probably would not be boneh because Ein Bin Yibikelim. But again, you have to know what Ein Bin Yibikelim means. What would be if I have something that's a raw material and I decide in my mind that it's going to be functional for me as is, and I'm not going to manufacture it, I'm not going to perfect it. Would I violate the malacha of Makabit Patish? When I've made that decision, it's a machshava, but I haven't touched the object. And what's the answer? Am I chayav for such thing? For sure not. Because again, the Torah doesn't recognize machshava. Machshava can't change an object. On Shabbos, we have to change an object. From that perspective, Shabbos fits in to a more universal context, a framework which requires either amira or maisa.
Well, Muktzah is machshava.
Correct. You know why Muktzah is machshava? Again, where you're taking a shiur that I'm preparing for next year out of my mouth here, but Muktzah is determined by Tumah V'Tahara. There's no way of learning Hilchus Muktzah and knowing what a keli is unless you learn Masechta Keli. That's why people learn Masechta Keli before they learn Masechta Shabbos. Because Muktzah is all over the place. There's probably not a perek in Shabbos, and Shabbos is one of the largest Masechtas in Shabbos that doesn't have Muktzah in it. But the Yesodis of Muktzah, and that's a sugi if you ever want to look it up on Daf Nun Gimel in Masechta Shabbos, is the Shem Kli of Tumah V'Tahara. That's Muktzah. But as far as Malacha D'oraisa is concerned, Malacha fits into the more universal pattern of Dibur, of Maisa, and Machshava is not enough. Now we get to the case of the Abdon. Now who is the Abdon? Literally, the tanner. He takes the raw material and he makes a final product on it, and once he's done so, he sells it on the market. At this point, in order to achieve his goal and satisfy his consumer, he's got to change the object. And therefore the Mishnah establishes that in such a case, ein machshava mitam osman. In other words, he may decide that he wants to use it, but his primary goal is to sell it on the market. That's how he makes his living. And therefore, when people buy it, they want to buy min olim, they want to buy full-fledged finished products, namely shoes in this case, and therefore, since his objective is to satisfy the buyer, then machshava cannot create the shame kli. The shame kli is going to be the function that he needs in order to satisfy his buyer. And what function is that? That requires gmar malach. Until he picks up his hammer and he does what he has to do, you know, with and shape, you know, with all his kalim, shape the shoes, it's not matan. Fine. That part of the Mishnah just sets the background for our discussion today, which is about a gazel.
What if he's selling tablecloths, though? I mean, if he's selling tablecloths, that would be the Gmar Malach for that.
That would be the Gmar Malach.
There is a Gmar Malach.
And then it would
that's
be a Kli.
Considered the Gmar Malach.
And then it would be a Kli. Then there would be no difference between a manufacturer and a Baal HaBayis.
Okay.
It's not his Machshava in this case. It's the nature of his business.
Yeah, so here me marav shach,
it's the same thing.
Either it's a kli because he's decided that it can function as it is, or if he's selling it because it would satisfy his buyer. So you have all conditions of men. What about a gazla? Now, if you want to say that the gazla made a decision that he wants to use these hides as is, meaning the raw material in its shape, then that should be a gemar molacha for him on a subjective level and his machshava to determine it. But I have one problem. That in order to determine the shame kli through machshava, I need the bailim. Is he the bailim? So this Mishnah in Masechta Kelim seems to assume that a gazlan is not a bailim. We'll soon see about a ganav. As I told you at the outset, this whole sugya is to try to figure out, compare and contrast, a gazlan with a ganav. Now keep in mind that this gazlan, on the one hand, faces his victim, the nigzal, in a face-to-face confrontation. Meaning the nigzal knows exactly who he is. And that gives the nigzal a certain advantage because he can do what? He can take him to court. On the other hand, let's look at the negative side of the equation. A gazlan, because he's so bold and he has such force, he's not afraid of anybody, certainly not of his victim. He's a tough guy. And it might be very challenging to get him into Bezdin. The two sides of the coin, as far as a gazlan, is going to be the subject of this Mishnah, and specifically the machlokas between Rabbi Shimon and the Chacham. The Tanakam of the Mishnah, the Chachamim, they say ein machshava metamosim in the case of gazlan, which means that there is no yesh. The Chachamim hold in a case of gazlan, insofar as I see the man, the whites of his eyes, and I recognize him, and I have recourse to take him to Bezdin. Again, there's going to be a gigantic machlokas as to whether this gazlan is a Jew or a non-Jew. Again, that depends upon the previous sugi that we learned. But let's try to put that on the side, because otherwise we're going to confuse two parashios here, Erev parashios. Whoever he is, I know who he is, whether he's a Jew or a God. And therefore I have recourse to take him to Bezdin. In such a case, I'm not willing to give up hope. There's no yesh. However, what about a case of someone who comes stealthily into my house and steals from me? I don't know who he is. I can't identify him. I can't put up signs, wanted, dead or alive, with his picture on it. Ganov, machshava mitam, shel ganov, machshava mitam osam. The ganov becomes the owner, the bailim, with the special power to determine that even if it's a raw material, his machshava clinches the shame kli. It's considered a gemar malach because he's in the driver's seat. He's the bailim. Because in the case of the ganov, I don't know who he is, and if I can't identify him, I have very little slim chances of ever getting him into a bezdin. Again, if there are two edim, that's fine, but this guy dug his way in as a burglar through the night. Where are the edim over here? Today we have security cameras, but back in the day they didn't have security cameras.
That wouldn't
and
count,
even today...
That wouldn't count, would it?
I think it would. I definitely think it would. But Maybe today, even for a ganov, if there's security cameras, there would be no yeish. So I guess in that case of a ganov, Bezdin would have to determine whether or not his picture was taken on the camera. If it was, then the violin, the nignav, is not going to be misyayish.
It seems to count only if he knew that there were cameras, because it's a function of whether or not of his. It's his personality. It's the ganov.
I don't think so. I'm not sure. I think again, what we're talking about here in our sugya, again, you might have something to do with Kefel and so forth and so on, but in our sugya, the question is whether the Nignav or the Nigzal anticipates taking this guy to Beis Din and getting back, retrieving his object. According to the Chachamim Shita, Dafka, in the case of a Gazlan where I identify him, in such a case, I hold out my hope and optimism, and I'm not going to be Misyayish because I believe that I can get him into a court of law. He's a tough guy, but I'll get him in and Beis Din will take care of it. Again, which kind of Beis Din, I don't know. Whether it's a Jewish Beis Din or not Jewish Beis Din.
That's only half of it.
Just one second. But in the case of a ganov, since I don't know who he is, then say the Chachamim, again, we'll see Rav Shimon in a minute. Let's hold on for Rav Shimon. Rav Shimon is also getting his time on the stage. The Chachamim, I'm trying to push for the Chachamim sheet, they're going to say in the case of a ganov, I'm going to give up hope immediately, because what are the chances that I'll be able to identify him and get him into a court of law? Numela says the Mishnah in the name of the Chachamim, there's an assumption here in the case of a ganov of Yeush. Why is there an assumption of Yeush? Because in the case of a ganov, insofar as the fact that I won't be able to be tovea him into Beis Din, I'm going to be misyayish. And it seems that the Mishnah here in Kalim is operating with the premise of Yeush. We don't even have to hear Yeush. There are no witnesses testifying to the effect that the Nignav was Misyayish. We can objectify this Yeush. We can assume this Yeush based on the fact that we don't know who the Ganav is. How are you going to ever get him into Beis Din? Again, that's just presenting the Shita of the Chacham. Rav Shimon Omer, Chiluf HaDvarim, as we say in Yiddish, Punkfaker, just the opposite. Shall Gazlan, he has a kinyan, because in the case of Gazlan, there's going to be Yeush Bailim. I have no hope, no anticipation that I'll be able to beat this guy in Beis Din. I don't even know if I'll be able to get him into Beis Din. He's such a tough guy that he accosts me face to face, and everyone's afraid of him. And I for sure am afraid of him, and therefore I'm Misyayish. If I'm Misyayish, part of the chain reaction here, the Gazlan is now the Bailim, and if he's the Bailim, he's in the driver's seat as far as taking raw material, and his Machshava is going to establish the Shem Kli, and therefore it's going to be Makabel Tumah. So I think there are about five premises here in the logic here of Rav Shimon. Premise number one is that in the case of a Gazlan, he is a very tough guy. Premise number two, because he's a tough guy, I don't have much chance, much hope of getting my object back by utilizing the force of the agency of Beis Din. Assumption number three, therefore, since I don't have much hope, there's a premise of Yeush. Assumption number four is that Yeush is Kona for a Gazlan. Assumption number five is that since he's the Bailim, therefore, in Hilchas Tumah Vitara, he's in the driver's seat, and his Machshava could determine the Gemar Malach. But Shalganov, now I know who he is, and I know that he's afraid of me. In such a case, I know who he is. Is ein machshava machshat matamosam, and here Rabbi Shimon spells it out explicitly. Fishelo nisyashu habaylim. Now, in order to put forward a powerful argument on behalf of Rabbi Shimon, the logic of Rabbi Shimon is that since in the case of a ganav, he's a scaredy cat, this ganav. He's not brazen and bold. He doesn't come and accost me face to face. In Beis Din, I'll get him into Beis Din, and therefore I'll be tovea him. I'll be able to retrieve my object. Of course, you might ask, how are you going to get him into Beis Din when you don't know who he is? Okay, so we're hoping that we'll find out who he is. You know, Sherlock Holmes, and we're going to pay a private detective if we have to. He took a piece of art from me, and I got to get that back, you know. So again, just to summarize, we have what's called a stam situation here. Omar Ula, let's see where I get the word stam from. Amar Ula Machlokes Bistam. Okay, let's just say a few words about the Stam. Stam means we don't know if there's Yesh. And now we have to kind of figure out, should we assume Yesh or should we not assume Yesh? That's called Stam. Chachomim come to one conclusion about Ganav and Gazlan. Reb Shimon comes to the exact opposite conclusion about Ganav and Gazlan. Let's start with Reb Shimon, because that's more fresh in our minds. Reb Shimon holds that in the case of Gzela, this guy's a tough guy, I don't hold much hope, and therefore I throw in the towel with Yesh. In the case of Ganav, he's a scaredy cat, and therefore I'm not Misyach. I'll be able to be Tover him in Bezd. The Chachom say just the opposite. The Chachom say in the case of a Gazan, I see him, I identify him, I don't need Sherlock Holmes, I'll somehow get him into Bezd. And therefore I'm not Misyach. In the case of a Ganav, I don't know who he is, how will I be Tover him into Bezdin, and therefore I am Misyach. So again, let's just formulate the two shitas. According to Reb Shimon, Stam Gzela is Yeirish, Stam Gneva is not Yeirish. Stam means we objectify it even though we don't know. We don't know that this individual. According to the Chachamim, Stam Gzela, there's no Yeirish. Stam Gneva, there is Yeirish. The factors that play in are twofold. Number one, do I identify him? Number two, do I have a real chance of getting him into Bezdin and succeeding in retrieving my object? The emphasis of the Chachamim is whether or not I identify him. In the case of a Gazlan, I identify him, and therefore I hold out with great hope and optimism of getting my object back. The Shita of Rav Shimon is to put all the emphasis on how tough of a guy is he. Is he a bold, brazen guy who comes with force? Is he a scaredy cat who is covered by the shadows of darkness? And that's going to determine Stam Yesh. Says Ula. And I think we could have written the text ourselves. Avol biyodua divrei hakol Yesh kani. In fact, when I read this line, I asked myself the following question. Why did I need Ula to bother telling you that? Ula is saying is that if we know for a fact that the Nignav or the Nigzal, again, Marikinisli, according to Rav Shimon and Chachamim, each case, made a Yeish. If we have evidence to that effect, then Yeish is Kani. And I know that's so, because the premise of this Mishnah is that Yeish is Kona. After all, we're talking about the Gazlan, we want to know if his Machshava could be Morid, the Shem Kli, for it to be Makabel Tuma. He's not selling it to anyone, there's no Shini Rishus. He didn't change anything, on the contrary, he's leaving it in its original state as a raw material, so there's no shinui. There was no shinui mamish, there was no shinui Hashem, there was nothing. All we have is yesh. And yet, the Mishnah establishes that machshavto mitamasan. Whose machshava is mitame? According to the shita of the Tanakama, it's the machshava of the ganav, because since I don't identify him, then I certainly stama yesh. According to the shita of Reb Shimon, it's the gazlan. There I'm misyash, because I'm afraid of this guy, and I don't have much hope. But bottom line is, both the Chachamim and Reb Shimon agree that Yeush is meaningful in the case of Gneva or Gzela. Both. The question is, do we assume Yeush, or do we not assume Yeush? That's a machlokas between the Chachamim and Reb Shimon. But if we know Yeish as a reality, it doesn't matter. So basically, we're wondering about what the Chiddush of Ula is, and we're going to find out the answer in just a few seconds, if you could hold on, because Rava, believe it or not, is going to disagree with Ula. But let's just say this. On a halachic level, not on a conceptual level, Ula is telling me two chidushim. He's telling me one Chiddush for the Chachamim, and that's going to be in the case of Gazlan, meaning that even, just one second, in the case of Ganav, right? No, Ganav is Stam, in the case of Gazlan, meaning, in the case of Gazlan, the Chachamim hold it, since I can identify him, I'm not Misyayish, comes along Ula and says, but maybe our Joe Plony was Misyayish, and therefore Yeish is meaningful. That's in the case of a Gazlan. According to Rav Shimon, in the case of a Ganav, we don't assume Yeush, because since he's a chicken belly, you know, he's a yellow belly, therefore I have hope that I'll get him into Bez and I'll get my object back. But if I was Misyayish, then Yeush is meaningful.
Rabbi, can you
just give me one more minute? But Rabbi Omar, this is mind-boggling. Biadua nami machlokis. Whoa, this is wild. Says Rabbi, even if the man declared Yeush, we have Adam to testify to that effect, Yeush is not meaningful. It's not going to be meaningful according to the Chachamim. Help me out here in the case of a Gazlan. Wait a minute, I always got to get the calculation. What, in the case of Gazlan, the Chachamim say is Ein Machshava Right. So in other words, according to the Chachamim, he holds out faith. What happens if his Mishyayesh comes along Rabba and he says, even though he's Mishyayesh, the Yeush is not meaningful? That's in the case of a Gazlan according to the Chachamim. Now let's take the flip side. A case of a Ganov according to Reb Shimon. According to Reb Shimon, in the case of Ganov, since he's yellow belly, he holds out hope. What happens if he says, I'm Mishyayesh, I give up? Says Rabba, the Ganov is not Kona. So again, according to the Chachamim, Rabba is saying that the Gazlan is not Kona, even though he was Mishyayesh. According to Reb Shimon, Rabba is saying that the Ganov is not Mishyayesh, even though he claims he was Mishyayesh. How do we understand Rabba? That's the problem. And I looked and I searched and I couldn't find anything, which means that I have to come up with something on my own.
Can't this be exactly what the Nesivos was getting at that you discussed 2 days ago? And when he needed the concept of the Yeush to come before they actually took hold of the Chayfetz. And since he needed the Yeush to come before that, then that would show that if the Yeush would have come after they already took hold of the Chayfetz, that in and of that would not have been okay.
But the only thing, Gedalia, if you're going to go with the Nesivos, again, I don't have the time now to go into the Nesivos, although I have the Nesivos with me, thanks, Yechiel. But again, what you're going to have to assume is that in this case, the Yeush came prematurely. Right, the Nesivos only says that in the case of a Matzil, if you remember, because he tried to reconcile the Reisha and the Sefer. We're not dealing about Hatzolah here, so I don't know if I want to use the Nesivos and start with Ukintas here, that maybe the Yeush took place. Right, the whole Chiddush of the Nesivos is that we're not dealing with Yeush of Gzela, we're not dealing with Yeush of Gneva, we're dealing with Yeush of an Aveda. And what pressed the Nesivos to say so, that if he's Mishyayesh before the Gneva or before the Gzela? You know, in the case of Gnev, actually, the Nesivos wouldn't even apply because he doesn't even know something is being stolen from him. So the Nesivos of Yeush before the actual Maisa Gzela or Gneva in this case would not be meaningful. So, Gedalia, if you want, we can discuss this after Shir more about the Nesivos, but we'd have to really go through the Nesivos carefully.
Just a question on Rabba. Does that mean he doesn't believe in Yeush Stam?
Well, that can't be, David. That's why the situation here is very bleak. It's very complex. Mm-hmm. You cannot deny Yeush. Because, again, in the Stam case, Yeush is meaningful. Whether it's meaningful in the Stam case of Gzela according to Reb Shimon, or the stomach case of Gneva according to the Chachamim, but definitely it's a presumption of Yeush. You can't tell me that Yeush is inoperative. Memela says Ula, since you have to agree that the whole Mishnah is predicated on Yeush, and Yeush is Kona on behalf of the Gazan and the Gan of Market Islay, therefore, Ula says if he made a declaration of Yeush, according to Reb Shimon in the case of a Ganov, or according to Chachamim in the case of a Gazlan, says Ula, certainly that Yeush would be meaningful, correct? Now comes along Rabba and he says no.
Doesn't matter what the guy says. We don't believe him.
So here I wanna take what you're saying, David, and just fine-tune it a little bit. It's a little bit too coarse for me, if you know what I mean, to say, well, we don't believe him. I mean, what, he's a liar? I mean,
he's 99% right, but he's holding out.
All right, so look, I'll tell you the truth, David. If you want to go with your approach, maybe even better than what I want to say. You know, maybe we don't really believe him. I would like to suggest the following. In this machlokes between the Chachamim and Reb Shimon, what are they arguing about? One way, which I think, David, you'll be very comfortable with, is to say they're arguing about human nature or human psychology. And we want to analyze the situation. It's very complicated. There are two variables that pull us in two different directions. One variable is, do I know? Am I aware of his identity? And the second variable is, do I have really a good chance of beating up this guy in Beis Din, of defeating him in quotation marks? And that's one way of learning it. And there's no doubt in my mind that's how Ula learned the Machlokes Shin Chachamim and Reb Shimon. Basically, there's a stoma, and we want to know whether stoma is an assumption of Yeyush or not, and the Chachamim go their way, and Reb Shimon goes his way. But maybe there's another way of understanding the Machlokes between Reb Shimon and the Chachamim. This halach of stam Yeyush is not a psychological analysis to try to second guess what the man is thinking, but rather it's an objective halachic statement or status. And what does that mean? I'll give you just a little bit of an example, just if you don't mind, but from left field, so to speak. There's a halach of mecha in Cheskas Gimel Shonim. What that means is that if I own the land and you're squatting on the land, then if you claim after 3 years of living on the land, let's say, for example, in an agricultural society that you harvested the produce, the produce, you marketed it, whatever you did for 3 years, then you can claim that you bought the field from me. And I will not be believed to say I didn't sell it. Unless I make a mecha. What's a mecha? I say, you know what? He's sitting on my land. I never sold it to him. He's a thief. Says the Rashbam in Masechta Bava Basra Perek Shlishi that a mecha requires another element. It's not enough for the Marakama to make a declaration, he's sitting on my land, I never sold it to him, he's a thief. The Rashbam says he must add three words, lemachar et be'enu bidin. Tomorrow, that doesn't mean literally tomorrow, like from Thursday to Friday. It means, li'achar zman, I will bring him into Beis Din. In other words, the Marakama, the owner, the original owner of the field, has to demonstrate, not only make a claim that he's living on my field, but more than that, he has to demonstrate his power, so to speak, to overcome any fear, his courage, if you will, to take this all the way to the courts. I'm not afraid of this guy. He's not a tough guy. He doesn't frighten me. I will be Tovea him Bidin. And this he has to make a claim in front of at least two Eidim, according to some, in front of three people, a whole tribunal. A miniature Beis Din, so to speak. Okay, leave that on the side. We're not learning Chesed Sabbat. Sigh of relief. But here, I want to suggest that this concept of lemachar et be'ena bedina is going to determine in an objective way whether or not this yeish. Yeish not as a psychological phenomenon, not as a mitzias, or what we call hotzal lefal. In other words, I'm not interested in knowing psychologically, did he give up hope or did he not give up hope? But the halacha is going to determine objectively whether or not this is yeish. Does the circumstance or the situation require generate yeyush? And the answer is, what are the chances of successfully retrieving the object, the chefetz hagon of hagazul, through a tvias bezdin, through the courts themselves? And here's where there's a machlokas between Rabbi Shimon and Chachamim. Rabbi Shimon claims the following. In the case of a gazlan, it's no longer lemachar et be'ena bedina. It's very, very difficult to assume that this gazlan is a gavra who is omed litvias bezdin. That's the chiddush of Rabbi Shimon. A ganav is a yellow belly. He's afraid. He comes b'machbu. This guy is a classical case of a defendant who could be sued by the tovea in Beis Din, by the plaintiff in Beis Din. But a gazlan already fits into a different category. Comes along Reb Shimon, and he's going to define yeush as the case of a gzela, as a gazlan. The gazlan is not someone who's lemachar yitbe'en abedina. He is considered an inish, a person who is alimta. Alimta means he's a powerful guy, he's a mafioso, he's a chutzpinyak, he doesn't care about, you know, societal regulations and limitations. He's not someone you can get into Bezdin. And even if you do get into Bezdin, he'll figure out a way of getting out of it. He's a tough guy. Comes along Reb Shimon and he says, that's called Yeish. We're not interested in what the Nigzal has to say about it. We're not going to knock on his door and say, Reb Yid, what do you think are the chances are of getting it back? That's not Rabba's approach. Rabba says, the machlokas between Reb Shimon and the Chachamim is a much more fundamental, conceptual machlokas. And it touches on an abstract principle of who is a gavra that is subject to a tvias bezdin. And here, there's a machlokas between Reb Shimon and the Chachamim. If we define X, whoever that guy is, either call him a gazlan or a ganav, that's going to be the subject of this debate between Reb Shimon and the Chachamim. If we define him as a gavra alimta, as a person to whom Bezdin is not going to be able to successfully force him to lose the case, so to speak, and cough up the goods, then that's called Yeish. Says Reb Shimon, gazlan fits the bill. He is a gavra alimta, he's not a gavra sheyit beta bedina, and if there's no serious possibility of being tovea this guy bedin, he's outside the parameters of the law, and we'll get to speak about muhsin, because muhsin really fits beautifully into the concept of a gazlan then, from Reb Shimon's perspective, because what recourse are you going to have to take the moches into the courts? The moches is representing the government, he's above the law, so to speak. Says Reb Shimon, that's called Yeish. And nothing less than that will do. Says Rabba, in the case of a ganav, who's a classical person, who's lemachar et be'en abedina, if I could borrow that term from the Rashbam, Yeish is meaningless. There is no Yeish. Because again, Yeish is objective. Yeish is determined halachically by classifying and categorizing the gav for the person himself. If we classify the ganav as a perfect example of lemachret ben ebedina, then yeish is irrelevant. It's meaningless. Comes along the chachamim, and they say just the opposite. You know what defines a person as et ben ebedina or not et ben ebedina? The circumstances of the crime, not the nature or the characteristics of the person, as we spoke about before, gavra limta, but is there a clear-cut evidence? Is there a presumption of Edim that would be the basis to launch a claim in the court against him? And here the Chachamim say objectively, when is there Yeush? In the case of a Ganav. The exact opposite of Reb Shimon. Because in the case of a Ganav, where's the Lamachet Ben Abedina? There's no one who saw the Gneva, presumably. Again, you know, we may hold that hope that there is someone out there who had, you know, a camera, one of these long-distance cameras, and he caught the guy red-handed in the, as the thief, as he stole the art piece, you know. But barring that very extreme circumstance, we have to assume that we won't find this kind of. We have nowhere to find him. It's a needle in a haystack. We have no witnesses and no evidence. He's a gavra who doesn't lend himself to a tvias bezd. Is memela, that's called yeish. Comes along the nigzal, and he says, I'm misyayish. What do you mean you're misyayish? There's no objective yeish here. The gazlan is clear. We know who he is. Now we have to gather together the posse and all the forces, and we have to bring him into bezdin and force him to return your object. You know, I'm thinking out loud, you know, in the case of loot that was stolen by the Nazis in Rosh Hashanah, this is what's going on. You know, the question is whether we, you know, whether we were able to determine who stole it, or at least maybe if we can't determine which Nazi stole it, at least we can determine who's holding on to it. And he also has a din of a gazlan. And therefore, we can say, well, can we get these guys into the court? Now, if this piece of art is owned by the Austrian government, for example, then it's very, if anyone knows what I'm referring to, Klimt, then how are we going to ever get this into the Austrian government? Unless the Austrian government is willing to recognize that the courts are above the government. And that's the subject of a golden, of an issue. So again, let's just summarize. Rabbosai, what I'm suggesting is following, that there's a fundamental machlokas here, two different perspectives on Rav Shimon and Chachamim. There's that of Ula and that of Rabba. Whereas Ula operates within a subjective realm, and Stoma means let's try to figure out, is this guy Messiah? Was he Messiah? Was he not? And therefore the whole machlok between Rav Shimon and Chacham boils down to a kind of psychological analysis and a presumption of Yeush. If the man explicitly declared his Yeush, then for sure Yeush is Kani. Or shall we say no? There's no such thing as a subjective element in Yeush. Yeush sets up an objective halachic status, a situation. And that power of Yeush is a Kenyan power on behalf of the Ganav and the Gazan. But who is going to have Yeush? Who does, it's the Ganav who's pulling for Yeush, it's the Gazan who's pulling for Yeush. So the Chachamim say, let the Ganav pull for Yeush and he'll successfully create Yeush. Comes along with Shimon, he says, no, it's the Gazan who pulls for Yeush, because in the case of Gzela, how are you going to get him into Bezdin and successfully get him to cough it up? In the case of Ganav, the Chacham say, how are you going to successfully get the Ganav into Bezdin and get him to cough it up? We don't even know who he is. Yeah, Gita.
I was thinking that according to your Chiluk, at least it can help understand the problem.
That's good. For once, you're supporting
the problem that you have.
This is Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish.
The problem that you have with Rabbi Shimon. Who's going to find the Ganav? If somebody stole from me, I can't find them, so I'm automatically Messiah. You don't care what I think. It's a Gavra that can be put to Bezdin. And therefore, by halachic definition, I don't care what you think.
In fact, I think I'm inclined more towards Rav Shimon, according to Rabbi, than I am towards Chacham. The Chacham are going to say that, you know what, in the case of a Ganav, he's a perfect category, a perfect classical case of someone that you could get into Bezdin, but the problem here is you don't know who he is. And that's where the Chachamim, I think, are going out on a limb over here, and they're saying, you know what, there's no Yeish in the case again, I got myself confused, according to Chachamim, in the case of Ganav, there is Yeish. And why is the Yeish in the case of a Ganav? According to Chachamim, we don't know who he is. And that puts him, so to speak, outside the pale of Bezdin. Now, again, if you take a look at a list, if you would enumerate or compile a list of all the cases that come to Bezdin, I think, with the exception of a Ganav, 99% of them are people that we can assume there's evidence against them. Talk about a Malva the Lover, talk about a Mazik and a Nizak, talk about a case of a Makna and a Kone, a Mocher and a Lokev. In all these classical cases, we're assuming that these are interactions between people that happen, within the normal course of events, and the Bezdin is going to be on top of it. Again, the plaintiff will bring his proof and evidence, and the defendant will counter with his proof, but Bezdin is on top of the situation. I think that Ganov, from the Chacham's perspective, is a very rare kind of scenario, because he went ahead and stole something. He snuck into your basement, and who is he? Go figure out how we get him into base.
He held it. You don't. Chacham held it. You won't get him into base. That's why.
That's exactly what I'm saying. That's why I'm saying that the Chachamim, I'm trying to defend the Chachamim here. Why do they see Ganov as such a special case? How can you tell me that, there's no Lamacher et Be'en Abedina? The whole of Choshen Mishpat is predicated on the assumption that Lamacher et Be'en Abedina. The answer is, because if you enumerate all the cases that are covered and addressed by Choshen Mishpat, I think you'll find that all of them, with one exception, are in the course of our maso matan, of our daily interaction at a monetary level, and therefore there's recourse to a Bezdin. Bezdin has a problem in the case of a Ganav, and that's what's going to generate Yeush according to Chacham in the case of a Ganav. So even though you may reject everything I said today, at least we're getting used to who holds what. That also is a...
So why did you say you liked Rav Shimon better?
I'm just saying that, in a sense, Rav Shimon has the upper hand. Why do I think Rav Shimon has the upper hand over here? Because when you talk about who's a person that you can get into Bezdin, right? Who's this Gavra that is described as Nitfas or Nitan Litovo? I think you'd have to say that depends upon these categories of individuals. We talk about Adamalimta. There's a Gemara also in Cheskes Sabbat, an amazing Gemara about Rav Murray, where he he tried to fool Bezdin. I mean, he's one of the Amoraim. And the Gemara said, why did you do that? Because he said, because this guy's a Gavra Alimta. And you can't deal with him in the regular way that you could deal with anyone else in the court system. Because I'll make you an offer you can't refuse, right? That's called a Gavra Alimta. Okay. Amalei Abaye l'Rabba. Lo tiflog alei de'ula. So Abaye believes that our Mishnah is going to prove that the whole business about Yeush and Aganav and Agazlan, it's all a question of psychology and it's all a question of Mitzius, and Ula is absolutely right. We can assume he was Mitzius, but even if we don't assume he was Mitzius, he may have been Mitzius before Mamish. Disnan b'mas nisen kavosei. How does our Mishnah support Ula? Says Abaye, I have a diuk in the Mishnah, which is almost explicit. It's just one hair's breadth less than explicit. It says in the Mishnah that Lefisha lo nisyashu habaylim. Look at the last line in the Mishnah in Taros, in Kelu, and in explaining Reb Shimon, and why does Reb Shimon hold that in the case of a ganav there is no yeush? Lufisha lo nisyashu abaylim. Now, there are two ways of reading that line in the Mishnah. One is because the baylim were not nisyash, and we're just describing reality. The other way is to say it, that there is no yeush in this case. Halachically, there's no yeush. Abaye understood, and that's what he told Rabbah, that Lefisha lo nisyashu abaylim is a description of reality. Taima de lo nisyashu abaylim, avol nisyashu abaylim hareu shalo. If we have testimony that he was misyash, he said the magic words, vayli lefisar kis, so then we have yeush baylim. Amalei, but Rabbah, for some reason, maybe because he wants to defend his shita against Ula, and he felt that he was a little bit slighted by a Talmud. Abaye was a Talmud chover of Rabbah, that he would come and say, well, there's a Mishnah that supports Ula against you, Rebbe, against my Rebbe Rabbah. So Rabbah was, you know, put on the spot over here. Or maybe just simply Rabbah wanted to tell Abaye that there are two ways of learning this Mishnah. He says, Hanan, Lefisha ein yeush lebailim masnisin la. Okay. Now, Tosis points out here, this is the third Tosis before the end, Ein magia ha-mishnah. Because Tosis knows that there's somebody like Azariah Berzon who thought, when I read this Gemara, that what Rav is doing is he's rewriting the text of the Mishnah. No. He's reinterpreting the Mishnah. Anan, he talks about himself in third person, I reinterpret the Mishnah. I'm not changing the text of the Mishnah, but really what the Mishnah means is not that the Gavra wasn't Misyash, right? As we read it according to Abaye, that lo Misyash Abaylam, he wasn't Misyash, but rather Ein Yeush Labaylam, that there's no Heftzah, there's no Halach of Yeush with regard to the Baylam, because it's not the Baylam who determined Yeush, but rather the objective Halachic categories, and whether or not this person is someone that you can get into Bezdin and be Toveh him Bibdin. Okay, now we get to our Mishnah. Now I told you before that Mochsin is considered Gazlan. And the reason for that is that the mochsin are in the light of day. There's no machbo here. There's no going into the, you know, into the shadows of darkness here. And they basically threaten, I don't mean that literally, but there's a threat that backs up their confiscation of property from the people from whom they collect these objects, because we're going to throw you into jail, my friend, if you don't offer whatever you have to offer as tax, in this case the chamor, or later on we'll have the case of the ksus. So what does it say in our Mishnah? The Mishnah says that notlo mochsin chamoro, so he takes the chamor from Reuven and he gives it to Shimon. And the Mishnah says that Shimon does not have to return this chamor to Reuven. And why is that? Because habaylim misyashim. Here we have an objective yeush in the case of a moches. Now a moches is a case of a gazlan. But the Mishnah continues. You see, it says v'chulei. And what is the next part of the Mishnah? Let's go back to our Mishnah. It's right here in front of our eyes. It says, not lo listim. And it says, hareilu shalo. Now, the case of listim is a case of a ganav. Again, don't get confused here, Rabosai. I'm going to save you the mistake that I made. My mistake was I thought listim are people who come with guns and they say to you, your money or your life. That's not what listim are. No. Listim is another word. You have the English translation?
Bandit. Yeah,
oh, I don't know.
That sounds like a gun-holding kind of guy.
Okay, so I don't know what he means by a bandit, but I'll write a letter to Dr. A here and tell him I'm not happy with his English translation.
So how do you define a listim?
Listim is a ganav, meaning he's a person who comes in stealthily. I wouldn't call him a bandit. You know, bandit to me is, you know, the old Western movies, yeah, with, you know, the guy has the kerchief around his half of his face, you know, Wyatt Earp and all that stuff.
A bandit, however, who hides from people.
That's
a thief.
Oh, that's very good. Oh, thief. That I like better than bandit. But at least the footnote saved us. Okay, I'm not going to write my letter to Dr. A because what footnote number is that?
47.
Can you find that, David? 47. Ah, okay.
Yeah.
So we have our own Torah Chaim. And no, there's no doubt that bandit is a bad translation. At least, again, I don't know what country he's coming from. As we know from the ELC, one thing, English divides up into five different languages here in the ELC. So what you mean in Australia by a bandit is not necessarily what I mean in New York City as a bandit. You know what I'm saying? But in my mind, a bandit is a gazlan.
Yeah.
And therefore, I would be very hesitant to say that listim is a bandit. But if you're saying he's a thief,
right?
Okay, I don't know. The word thief could be many different things in different languages, but a thief might be a person who
He's hiding his identity.
Yeah, that's the main point. He's hiding his identity.
Yeah, they put their little handkerchief around there.
Correct. So maybe that's a bandit in the Lashon HaArt scroll. Okay. Right. Fine. In any event, the Mishnah now is making a sweeping statement, all-inclusive, that both in the case of the Moches, who's a gazlan, and in the case of listim, who's a ganav, there is yeyush bailin. So the Gemara is very concerned about this. E rabbanon kasha gazlan, the e rabbi Shimon kasha ganav. Rabbi, the rabbanon say that there is an assumption of yeyush in the case of the unidentified person, because how are we going to get him into Beis Din? And that's called a ganav. So why does the Mishnah say that even a Moches, who's definitely identifiable, in that sense he's a gazlan, he's not coming stealthily, he's not hiding his identity, there's Yeush Bailin? And if you go like Reb Shimon, which was stuck with the case of Ganav, because Reb Shimon says there's no Yeush in the case of Ganav, he's a yellow belly, he's a chicken, and he's afraid, we'll get him into Beis Din, we'll force him to pay. He doesn't have that power to confront the Beis Din and tell them to fly a kite. Oh, so here the Gemara thinks we have a good move to make if we hold like Ula. Bishleim ula ula di amar biyadua kani. If you're going to say that Ula is talking about Yeush as a mitzius. Ah, if Yeush is a mitzius, then hachanami biyadua. Maybe we could say that our Mishnah, again, it depends on whether it's the ganav who's yadua or the gazan, that depends on Rav Shimon and Chachamim. But whatever it is, we'll call it I think it's something. Anyway, it's a case of yadua.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're up to yadua.
Ula doesn't care.
How did the time fly so fast? I don't know.
Ula doesn't care about the language. He doesn't care what you call him.
Excellent. It's very hard to put yadua into our Mishnah. The Mishnah says mitnei shabayla misyashim. It's not a question of did we hear it from him or did he not. So the word yadua here In this context is very complicated. It doesn't fit into our mission. I want to take this opportunity to wish everyone a Shabbat Shalom. And
do you have Shir on Tuesday, or Tuesday you're leaving about Shir?
Tuesday, I don't know. It's really on the borderline. My flight leaves at 4 p.m. So I don't know. Is anybody willing to learn at 11?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. 11:30. I mean, it's 11:30. So you know what? Let's make it 11, and you know, we'll see if we can work this all out. Okay, then. So I'll go from here to the airport.
How long you?